Welcome back to the FKG podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today, I'm joined by Kelly Halpin, who recently broke her own unsupported FKT for Wyoming's Wind River High Route. Drop in to hear why Kelly returned to this remote, burly mountain FKT and what she loves about the unsupported modality. Thanks, Kelly, so much for coming on the show today. I'm really excited to chat with you about your Wind River High Route FKT.
I am so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's first of all talk about what the Wind River High Route is, where it's at, how long it is, elevation, all that good stuff.
This is the Skirka variation of the Wind River High Route created by Andrew Skirka. And it's, I believe, 97 miles long with around 30,000 feet of gain. And then, of course, with little variations, it could obviously be like a mile shorter, or my watch said 100 miles and a half mile in change at the very end. It's a really beautiful, generally non-technical route through the high country of the Wind River Range in Wyoming, which I believe is the most remote mountain range in the lower 48. It's incredibly beautiful. It is incredibly remote. The route crosses many passes around 10 to 11, maybe even 12,000 feet. And you cross a number of glaciers. 65% of it is off trail. And you are on a lot of talus forever and ever.
Never-ending talus.
Sometimes small, sometimes the size of houses. Your feet are usually wet because you're either crossing streams, creeks, or you're in the snow. And yeah, it's really gorgeous. Lots of wildlife out there. Sheep, elk, bears, mountain lions. It's a full wilderness experience.
Yeah, the Wind River Range is one of my favorite places. I love it there. It's incredible for all the reasons you just talked about. You mentioned you did the Skirka variation. So what other variations are there?
So there's a Wilson-Dixon variation that I've fastbacked before, although it doesn't go over any of the northern glaciers on the Wilson-Dixon. You come out Green River and you miss some of the northern aspects of the range on that one, but it's also really beautiful. There's also the Highline Trail. I haven't done that, but I have a lot of friends who have run that, and that one is on a trail, which is nice. I believe that is part of the CDT. Acts on that.
The CDT, I think, follows the High Line for a lot of it.
Yeah, but it's a gorgeous range. And I think any trail you take through the Wind Rivers is going to be pretty magical.
So this was not your first go around with this variation, the Skirka variation. In fact, you broke your own record out there, which is what we're going to talk about in a minute. But I'm curious, what drew you to the Wind River High Route in the first place? Like, why did you come out here and set an FKT on it in 2020?
Well, I'm from Jackson, Wyoming. So the Wind Rivers are my neighbor mountain range here. I spend a lot of time in the Tetons, but when you really, really want to get remote, you go to the Winds. And in, I'd have to double check, but 2017, 2018, my friend Ryan Burke and I set the FKT on the Wilson-Dixon High Route. That was really fun. We did it fast packing style, and it was at the same time as the eclipse. So that was really cool. We got to see that the morning after we finished. And the whole time we were talking about other routes in the Winds, and he goes, oh, well, there's also the Skirka variation of the High Route, which is generally the classic High Route that most people are familiar with. And it's 100 miles, and it's a little bit burlier than the Wilson-Dixon, in at least my opinion, longer. And I was just really intrigued by that. And so for the next couple of years, I kind of had my eye on, at some point, taking the time to get to know the Skirka variation of the High Route. And in 2020, I went out and started scouting sections of the route. There's sections that you can run from like Big Sandy to Lander. And I fast packed a northern portion of it. Unfortunately, because I had to have a friend bail on the fast packing, I ended up missing a section in the middle. So that part was mostly an on-site when I went for the attempt. But the Winds, it's very time committing to get in and out of there because they're so remote and the trailheads are usually like 20 miles before you get to the High Route itself. So it does take a while to investigate the route. So anyway, yeah, 2020, and I wanted to go for it, and I wanted to do it unsupported because that's my favorite style. I had a really amazing experience. It was beautiful. It took me 59 and a half hours. And I wanted to do it in sub 60, so that worked out great. But of course, as with everything, once you do something once, you learn all the little places you can either make up time or do it better. And for the last 4 years, I've just been wanting to go back and give it another try and really just do it better overall. Like, just be better with my feet, be better with my gear, and give the route the obviously the respect it deserves because it is such a incredibly beautiful and burly route and remote route. I wanted to not only drop my time down, but do better on the route itself.
Well, obviously you achieved that goal because you took 6 hours off of your time. So what do you think were the biggest contributors to that? You mentioned gear. Did you change your gear a lot between the two, or was it just having that familiarity with having done it before?
It was a mix. I took better care of my feet. That made a big difference. I got some pretty terrible blisters the first time I did it because I got lazy about switching out my socks on the last 20 miles. And I should have switched them out. They got pretty wet and caused some incredibly painful, absolutely gigantic deep blisters that took a very long time to heal afterwards. It actually got so painful on my exit the last time that I had to bite down on a stick to continue walking.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they were really bad. And so I was like, well, there's one aspect. And obviously navigation, so much of the route is off trail. So you have to always be on your game. Like, okay, is this the best line here? Is this the best line here? And it's very complex terrain. So sometimes it's hard to pick a good line. And 10 days before this last time on the high route, I went and fast packed a huge portion of it again, like 70 miles of it, just to make sure I could really hone in on some of those lines and get other aspects of it dialed down, like pick the best line through this pretty heavy forested section so I wouldn't get bogged down by all the trees and schwacking and whatnot, and to try to time everything really well with the snow fields and the glacier crossings. And I'm also just more familiar with how my body deals with that kind of sleep deprivation and how to fuel better. So it was a whole bunch of combined little things to add up to the 6 hours I cut it down by.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially what you're saying about picking good lines, especially when you're talking about talus. I feel like there are the ones that don't move as much as the others, and you just have to know where those are. Sometimes that can help. There's a few things I want to go over that you alluded to in that. But so my first question, when you're talking about picking good lines and knowing where you're going, when you're out there off trail in the dark, how are you staying on a good line? Like, how does being out there in the dark affect what you're doing here?
Well, fast packing it ahead of time helped. I was following a GPS on my phone from my last time through, mixed with a line from my previous attempt, and I was trying to combine those. And obviously, you don't always stay on those lines, but yeah, at nighttime, it was tricky, and I definitely still had some navigational issues, especially because there was a delay on Caltopo and Gaia. So I was trying to get off of this very, very cliffed off peak. And I kept missing the arete that you down climb. And I don't know, it was trouble. And I also did it during the moon was only at like a sliver. It was right before the new moon. So there was almost no moonlight. And I knew that was going to hinder me, but it was also the right time of year to go and do it. So I didn't want to wait too long because it does get very cold up there very fast. But yeah, nighttime, you just hope you're staying on the right line.
Right. You mentioned the sleep deprivation a little bit and how your body deals with that. How much did you sleep? What was your sleep strategy?
So in 2020, I stopped to try to take a 30-minute nap after about 24 hours in. So I was about at mile 50 at that point in 2020. And I was like, all right, this seems like a good time to try to take a little dirt nap. But I was at 12,000 feet and it was so cold, I couldn't sleep. And so I ended up wasting time trying to fall asleep, which made me feel more fatigued. And then I got colder and then I was wasting time. I had an emergency blanket, but that doesn't really do much for you after a while. So I did manage to get probably 15 to 20 minutes of sleep on the ground, but I was so cold, it was uncomfortable. My rule this time around was that if I was going to stop, it had to be during the daytime in full sunlight so that I could use that solar energy to stay warm. And even then, I still needed to put a puffy on. But yeah, this time I stopped down a little bit lower, only to the point when I felt like I was wobbling off the route. And I was like, all right, you have a mountain you have to climb tonight in the dark, and there's going to be no moonlight. So you need to stop. So I stopped. I put my feet up on a tree to elevate them because they were pounding. They were all swollen.
Right.
And I closed my eyes for about 9 minutes. Didn't fall asleep. My feet actually hurt so bad I wasn't able to fall asleep, but I took 9 minutes and did some deep breathing, like yoga breath work. And after 9 minutes, I got up and it felt like I had slept for 12 hours and I kept going.
Oh,
so
wow.
This time I did not sleep at all, but I did take the 9 minute break and that reset the whole system. And yeah, I felt really refreshed afterwards.
Wow. Yeah. It's amazing how even just a short break, even if you don't fall asleep, can have that much impact. You mentioned your feet were hurting too much to fall asleep. So were the foot problems the same? I mean, you said you took better care of your feet this time, but was it just the pounding? Did you end up with blisters again? What was happening with the feet?
They were fine. They were just pounding because it's just a lot of time on your feet. They were just doing that thing where they just throb really bad.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no major blisters this time. I had some little toe blisters at the very end, but my feet were pretty good this time. And I was really happy about that.
Yeah. If the feet aren't happy, it's hard to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned wildlife earlier. So what kind of wildlife did you encounter out here?
Well, when I started at, was it 2:25, I think, in the morning, roughly around 2:30 when I started. It's also roughly around the same time I started last time. As you're climbing up into the alpine zone, you're in a lot of pretty heavily forested landscape, and there were eyes watching me everywhere. I have never seen so many animal eyes watching me. I mean, sometimes you could tell it was probably a herd of elk or deer, but other times it was a solitary animal from above watching me. And I was like, that could be a cat. That could be a bear. Right. Maybe it's a sheep. So that first couple of hours, I definitely encountered the most wildlife, although I'm not entirely sure what I was looking at. But they were definitely looking at me, whatever it was.
Right. They were watching you go by.
They were definitely watching me go by. And for the record, I was carrying bear spray. I saw a lot of sheep. That was really cool. I didn't see as many sheep last time. Last time I saw a bear, I did not see a bear this time. So that was kind of nice, actually.
Preferable.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of elk, moose, porcupine. Almost ran into a porcupine in the night. That was fun. He shook his butt at me, but he waddled away.
Right. I've talked to so many people doing FKTs that they run into porcupines because that's when porcupines are out. And it seems like most of the time, and I've had this happen to me too, the porcupine is kind of just like, I don't care that you're here. And yeah, do the little shake the quill thing. And then they just kind of waddle along and do their thing. They're just totally nonplussed by your presence.
Yeah, they're fine. They're doing all right.
Yeah. You mentioned seeing a bear and you had bear spray. So are we talking black bears, grizzly bears? What kind of bears are we talking about here?
The last time it was in the cirque at dusk, so I couldn't see the color really well, but it was definitely a large bear. I couldn't tell you if it was a black bear or a grizzly bear, but it was a large bear and it was bounding away from me pretty fast. So he was going in the opposite direction. So that was nice.
That's good. Yeah. I have never seen a bear in the winds, but I know they're there.
They're there. I've seen a couple now at this point. They're not as frequent as in other ranges, but they're out there.
Right, for sure. Yeah, I've seen a lot of moose and I've seen wolves, but no bears. And of course, the deer and the elk. Going back to your gear, I've got two questions. The first is, you've mentioned glaciers and that this is a burlier route. So were you carrying any sort of technical gear, like crampons or anything like that? How are you handling glaciers?
So being familiar with the route and going pretty light, I knew where a lot of the crevasses were already. I brought micro spikes with me, although I didn't actually need to use them this time. I did use them last time because the snowfield I was crossing was frozen and it was very steep. But no, I didn't personally bring anything more than micro spikes in my poles. But that is just based on the fact that I'm pretty familiar with the route at this point, and I know where some of the larger crevasses are, especially on the Grasshopper Glacier. And they had opened up at the time I was doing the FKT attempt. So it was nice to avoid those. They were pretty big, right? Actually. I don't think I'd seen them open up that big before.
I mean, you mentioned being pretty cold, but the crevasses were open. Was it warmer than normal there? Did you have that heat wave that everybody else seemed to get? Did that seem to open up the glaciers?
Yeah, a bit. So I was actually going to do all of this a week earlier, which would have been better with the moonlight. But because of the huge heat wave, I ended up having to postpone my fast pack by a week, which then I had to recover from that before I could do this attempt. So everything got pushed back a week. But the rapid melting happened right before I fast packed. And I heard that there were wet slides and it was a mess out there. The glaciers were pretty sloppy when I went through them, both fast packing and when I went for the attempt. Sometimes I was busting through to the glacier on meltwater up to my knees, and you kind of have to use your poles to poke around and make sure you're not walking into a flooded crevasse when you're doing that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, the glaciers are pretty mushy, and the day I went for the attempt was actually a pretty cold day. I was wearing my puffy for a lot of the day, and it ended up snowing at certain points on the route that day. And even with the colder temps and the cloud cover, some parts of the snow were slippery and hard to navigate, and other parts were really, really sloppy, and my feet were just constantly wet. I mean, your feet are pretty much going to be wet most of the route. As hard as you try to keep them dry, you're just crossing a lot of snow and or going through boggy areas.
We talk about a little bit about the glaciers. What other kind of, like, obviously you're off trail. I mean, I've been back there. Like, it's pretty steep and rocky and there's talus. Are you doing any sort of scrambling as well? Like, is there any sort of technical or semi-technical rock that you're on, or is the technicality mostly just when it comes to glaciers?
So I think Skirka was trying to design this, from what I've read, to be non-technical, although there are a few passes you go over that are pretty messy. And I tend to scramble. I'll go off to get out of the loose rock and scramble instead of going up the loose rock. And I mean, it is so loose that if you kick a rock off, it's going all the way to the bottom. Going up the backside of Wind River Peak at the end is like 2,000 feet of the most heinous loose rock. I'm very surprised that it's part of the route because it's so heinous. I can't imagine what it's like to go up or down that with a backpack on. It just seems so sketchy. I know a lot of people actually, when they do the route backpacking, they go around the side or they take an alternative route so that they can avoid going over that. But I don't know if I would say that the route is fourth class in any way unless you choose to make it fourth or fifth class. And like I said, I've gone off to the side of the gully and scrambled instead because I trust the solid rock a lot more than I trust the loose rock.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So you mentioned not imagining being able to do it with a pack on, like a backpack, but you obviously had some pack weight. How much did your pack weigh and what was in your pack? I'm assuming food. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. I think people always love to hear what you're eating. But what else was in your pack and how much did it weigh?
Well, let me just start with the gear. So I was using a Black Diamond 15-liter pack, which was just perfect, especially because I get colder, so I needed to carry extra layers for myself. I know people who have done it with smaller packs, but they've also been very chilly. So I've talked to both David Ayala and Gabe Joyce, who have records on it, as well as other people who've gone for attempts on it. We always like to talk about what gear and how cold you want to be. So yeah, I had a 15-liter pack and I carried about maybe four and a half pounds of gear before the food was in there. So I had micro spikes, which I'm still glad I had them, even though I didn't have to use them this time. I had poles. I was wearing gaiters over my La Sportiva Mutants, which were the shoes I use. I had emergency equipment. So I had an emergency blanket if I needed it. I had a pretty basic first aid kit, kind of minimal, because the idea is hopefully you don't get so hurt that you have to call it a chopper. And if you get injured, hopefully you can get yourself out with minimal gear. But besides the layers, which were rain pants, puffy jacket, rain jacket, and all of those I ended up using. Headlamp and an emergency headlamp. And then I had an InReach, so I was doing tracking with a group of friends. I did not actually do public tracking this time, which I did last time, because I actually saw someone get assaulted in the winds just a couple of weeks ago. So it kind of scared me, so I didn't actually want to have the public following me. So yeah, I had two soft flasks, one for electrolytes, one with a filter, so that I wouldn't put electrolytes in the filtered one so you don't mess up your filter. That had a separate soft flask. I had a lighter. I had a bag that had a small recharge battery for my headlamp if I needed to do that, or my phone, which I was navigating from. Mutants, ChapStick sunscreen. And I brought a physical map with me because I really believe that if technology can fail, it will fail. And you don't really want to be caught out there. I generally know where most of the trailheads are and where most of the exits are at this point. But I think it's really good to have the route on a physical map in case things get screwy out there. And trust me, the mountain spirits will screw around with your technology out there. So watch out. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the weight I carried was food, which was a mix of real food like pasta, mashed potatoes, which I froze in the Ziploc before I went out, chips, salami, string cheese. I really like string cheese, cookies. And then everything else was like gels and chews, electrolyte powder.
Do you know about how many calories you carried?
Definitely not enough, but I only ate about half of what I brought. I probably brought 8,000 calories with me.
So you only ate about four?
Probably four to five. I had about half of my food left over afterwards, mostly because at night I have a very hard time eating because it just is screws around with your system is not used to shoving calories down in the middle of the night, especially during the second night. I was just like, oh no, no more of these gels. So I do not recommend that to anyone. Eat all your calories. I got much better in the last 20 hours of eating. I think I have some kind of a survival scarcity thing where I'm like, oh no, I have to save my food in case I need it, even though I've already obviously measured it out and I should be eating a certain amount every hour. So yeah, it wasn't the best job eating, but I still felt like I did an okay job. It was certainly enough to get me through with plenty of energy.
Mm-hmm. How did that compare to what you took last time, food-wise?
It was actually similar. I brought more sweet stuff with me last time because I hadn't really honed in on the savory treats that I like to bring more. And I have a hard time eating sweets. So I ended up with, I think, a lot of extra food weight last time as well. Mm-hmm. But I've kind of honed in on what I like gel and chew wise now. Power Bar makes these cola chews that I really like, and it never upsets my stomach. I can just keep eating those for, even if I'm not hungry, I can just like pop one in and it gives you a little boost. I brought a lot of neutral gels. I really don't like flavored gels. So tons and tons of neutral ones. And I was actually really, really happy with that this time. And I didn't really get any mouth fatigue eating that. So that was really nice. I think last time I brought peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, which I didn't want anything to do with. By the end of that, I was just like, I am so not interested in this.
Right.
And of course, at that point, it's just a ball of mush.
It's just mush. Yeah. The bread's saturated. And
yeah.
I've done that.
But I know other people can do it with just chews and gels, but I can't personally. I need a mix of real food with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I end up with almost like sores in my mouth when I'm just doing only sweet stuff. I have to have some real food in there. Did you use caffeine at all?
Just with the cola gummies. Actually, no, I did. I brought a couple of just raw coffee beans with me and I just ate those in the morning to sort of trick my head into thinking, coffee in the morning, you know? I mean, it's the same as bringing chocolate covered espresso beans. I just didn't put chocolate on them.
Didn't bother with the chocolate part.
Yeah. But yeah, besides that, I just used the cola chews, which have a bit of caffeine in them.
Earlier, you were talking about having the InReach and a minimal first aid kit and that sort of thing to deal with any sort of injuries. Did you end up needing to use your first aid kit? Did you get injured at all out there aside from the pounding feet?
No, I was fine. I will say, though, that I've taken wilderness first aid courses, and I think that anyone who's going out in the mountains, especially for long periods of time like that, especially if you're going solo, you should educate yourself on wilderness medicine, wilderness first aid, so you know what you can use and how to get yourself out of a situation if you have that option.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, you live in Jackson, so did you have any issues with the altitude? Did it affect you at all?
No, I was actually fine this time. Last time, I got a little queasy a couple of times. That also might have been just because of maybe either lack of calories or pushing hard. Sometimes when you're going that long and you're pushing these really big uphills, you can get kind of queasy. But I think the only thing that happened both this time and the last time I was out there, and similar when I fast pack, is your sinuses get kind of blown up because you're up so high and you're breathing. And I'm usually a nose breather, so my sinuses ended up swelling up so much I had to mouth breathe usually at the end. And then I get these crazy bloody noses.
Oh.
Which happened a lot. That happens to me in the mountains all the time. I'm like, oh, it's not rocket. And then I'm like, oh, just kidding. And it's just the faucets turned on. And I'm like, oh boy, here we go.
That happens to me too. And I didn't realize it. So it's inflamed sinuses. Is that?
I think it's like dry air and inflamed sinuses, just really drying out everything. And then my mouth ended up getting really dry because I was mouth breathing. And then,
right.
Yeah. And then my kind of messed up and it was hard to eat because everything hurt, especially salt and vinegar.
Yeah. I just always figured it was dry air, but yeah, it's pretty much predictable with me. Every time I go to any desert or dry area or high altitude, yep, there's a nosebleed.
Mm-hmm.
So you were mentioning when you were talking about having the paper map, knowing where the trailheads were. So this is an extremely remote route. The winds are very far back there, especially the high part. Did you have bailout points? Did you have plan like, okay, if something goes wrong, this is how I get out from here? Are there options to really bail out of this route when you're out there?
Yeah, you can bail out. It's just going to be a very long commitment. 20 miles to a trailhead, and then you hope somebody's there. There's a very large portion of it, especially on the eastern side. Those are very remote trailheads. I'm not really familiar with those. If I were to bail out, it would probably be over to the Pinedale side if I had to. Big Sandy, Green River Lakes, Elkhart, especially because there's more people there. So if you needed help, I think that's the direction you would want to go. But besides Big Sandy, you're almost always about 20 miles out from a trailhead. Big Sandy's the closest one to the high route, and that's about 10 miles. So it is pretty high commitment. I've had a friend who was attempting the high route a couple years ago, and he ended up breaking through a snowfield, and it was like 22 miles for him to get out with a broken rib. Another friend of mine, actually a friend who was with him on that, Jeff, said, in order to do the high route, you have to survive the high route.
Right.
Because there's just so many little tiny things that could go wrong with the talus or the snowfields or weather. You're very, very vulnerable up there. So I do hope anyone who goes either to backpack it or to do a fast attempt on it, it definitely give the mountains your respect. You need to understand what's going on out there and how to get yourself in and out safely.
Right. And you mentioned the weather. What was the weather like for you?
So the first day there was some unexpected rain and snow. It was supposed to be clear, but you're in the mountains and you're in Wyoming, right. So that usually doesn't happen. It was snowing. I was really cold. It was really gray out and hazy. So there had been some really bad smoke that had come in. But then on top of that, there was this dreary drizzle that sat around all day and I was getting snowed on and the wind picked up and then it was windy all night long. And the wind is the most exhausting weather of all time. It's just relentless. But then the following day, through the following night, and then the next morning when I finished, was very beautiful weather.
Yeah.
It was warmer. I wasn't shivering the whole time, which is a real treat.
Yeah, I would imagine too, like being on Talus and stuff when it's drizzly, that's going to slow you down because you don't want to fall. And that is the rock getting super slippery and causing problems there.
I didn't get like any downpours. It was kind of just like drizzle. But some of those rocks, once they get wet, they're quite slick and it's just, you know.
So you mentioned earlier that you like to go unsupported. So why unsupported? Why is unsupported the way you like to experience the mountain?
I get the most out of that kind of experience. When I go after these bigger FKTs or bigger adventures in the mountains, it's cool to go after a record, but I think having a much bigger, more meaningful experience is really what I'm searching for. And I feel like I really get a lot more out of it if I'm doing it almost the hardest way possible, which is psychologically the hardest way possible. It's very lonely. You go through a lot of mental hurdles when you're out by yourself. You have no one to talk to, no one to depend on. The risk management is obviously very different. And I feel like the higher the buy-in, the more you get out of it. And I personally just really like the type of confidence and exploration you get from doing things like completely unsupported. Not that there's anything wrong with going supported. I think it's a lot of fun to do runs with friends and the fellow trail runners, especially when you can help yo-yo each other and push each other along, especially during nighttime pushes. But yeah, there's something pretty special about being by yourself and relying on yourself and relying on all of the knowledge you've accumulated throughout your entire life to be out and to move in a landscape like that in a kind and respectful and a magical way, being a part of the landscape.
Very well said. All that to say, what's next? What is your next mountain adventure? What do you have in mind?
I've spent the last year and a half putting together some new routes in the Gros Ventre range, which is also a neighborhood range in Jackson. And it's very beautiful, very remote. There's not a lot of trails and it's really incredible terrain. So it's been really fun to explore that. I have two established routes so far. There's a third I am currently working on that I'm hoping to do later this month, although I am going to do it during the moonlight because last year I didn't get a chance to complete it because there was a lot of cliffs and without having moonlight to help guide me on this section I needed to on-site. I very rarely bail off of things and this was sort of like, yeah, this is not smart to be out here. I should get off of this. So there's a project I need to finish. It'll be about 50 miles, maybe a little over 50 miles with maybe 16,000-17,000 feet of gain, a little bit more than that in the end, but I'm working on that and I hope I get a weather window and an opportunity to finish that. And then I've got a bunch of shorter little projects, which is always kind of fun because you end up training for these very, very long, long attempts. But then I think it's also really fun to try to move fast, even though the training's completely different. And then this hasn't been announced publicly yet, so I can't fully talk about this, but I am going to go do a pretty cool race in the fall overseas somewhere. So that'll be really exciting. And I'm really looking forward to that adventure and talking more about that when it's public.
It sounds like you've got a lot of really great upcoming adventures and plans. So I look forward to following along on those.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm excited to share my experiences with everyone.
Yeah. Thanks again for coming on the show today. It's been great chatting with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you again for having me. I'm always happy to talk gear with people if they ever want to reach out.
Thanks again, Kelly, for coming on the show. You can read about her FKT on the website fastestknowntime.com and follow her adventures on Instagram at KYEHalpin.